time to build up, a time to break down, a time to dance, a time to mourn, a time to cast away stones, a time to gather stones together, to everything turn.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. And the Mark Steiner Show is brought to you in part by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, offering a full range of financial services. MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. Remember, it's a credit union, not just a bank. It belongs to you. Money comes back in the end. More information at www.mecu.com or at steinershow.org. MeQ, Baltimore Credit Union's banner is there. There was a report that came out by one of our guests, Dr. Kristen Mowry, who is an assistant professor in the Department of Population, Family, and Reproductive Health at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, at the Centers for Adolescent and Global Health, that laid out realities about what life is like in poverty for young people and comparing a number of cities around the world, cities like Baltimore, New Delhi, India, Ibadan, Nigeria, Johannesburg, South Africa, and Shanghai, China. It was done in 2013. And this report is just glaring not just about what happens to young people in poverty around the globe, but specifically pulling out Baltimore City and Johannesburg as places that are in some ways more severe than places in Nigeria and China, which will come as a shock to many people. So we're going to talk about that, and we welcome Dr. Kristen Mowry to our program. Good to have you with us.
Great. It's great to be here.
I'm glad you're with us. And Dr. Ronnie Ellington's in studio. She's an associate professor of mathematics education at Morgan State University, works a lot with children who come from these circumstances, spent her life doing that, and she joins us in the studio. Good to have you with us once again, Ronnie.
Hey.
And Dr. Lawrence Brown joins us once again, political activist and public health consultant, an assistant professor of public health in the School of Community Health and Policy at Morgan State University. He tweets at Be More Doc. That's D-O-C. Good to have you with us too, Lawrence.
Morning.
And you all can join us at 410-319-8888. Write to us at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet me at Mark Steiner. Log on to our Facebook pages. But please, if you can, call in 410-319-8888. Let me just start in a sense, which really is not this, the mundane, Dr. Mowry, just to talk about what this outline this study, how it began and what you did.
Sure. So we were giving a grant to kind of understand what it's like for adolescents in disadvantaged urban environments around the world. And the big overarching question was, how can we connect these adolescents in disadvantaged communities to health? And what do we know about it? And when we started looking more into this, we realized there really is not a whole lot of cross-cultural, cross-comparison research on this. And given that the rise of urbanization is occurring so much throughout the world, and especially in these cities, with adolescents having the largest proportion making up the population in the cities, we were just really perplexed by why don't we know more about this. So that's what started the study. And so we did the study in two different phases. The first phase was a qualitative phase, where we really were just wanting to know from the adolescents themselves in each of these communities, what are their primary health concerns and what do they think influences their health more than anything. So as part of this qualitative phase, we did a number of different methodologies. One was a photo voice, where we trained adolescents in each of these communities how to use a camera. And then we basically had them take pictures of what it means to be healthy in the community and how do they see health in their community. And then we did community maps with each of them, where they were asked to draw a map of their neighborhood and then to describe the neighborhoods to us in terms of what they know about the services and all of that. And then we did in-depth interviews as well as focus groups with them to try to get more in-depth. And one of the things that came out of this phase, the first phase, that we were not expecting, is that adolescents across each of these sites really were very concerned about how their community looked like. In other words, what we call the physical environment. So we have an abundance of photos that showed garbage and, in Baltimore, rats. They took pictures of vacant buildings. And when we asked them to kind of elaborate, like for Baltimore and Johannesburg, the girls were really, they were talking about kind of this lack of recreation activities that that was occurring in both of the cities, Baltimore and Johannesburg, like I said, we didn't hear that in the other sites as much. So when we asked them to kind of explore what that meant, they're like, well, you know, what do you think then? If we don't have anything to do, there was a great quote by a girl in Baltimore, and she said, you know, this causes us to reproduce a lot because all we have is really school, and then when we go home, we lay on our beds. And so that really kind of opened up our eyes a bit, and we wanted to explore further. And so we did a survey among approximately 450 to 500 adolescents in each of these sites for the second phase. And that was really to build on what we found out as part of the first phase. So the survey covered things like the physical environment. We covered witnessing community violence, safety, as well as a number of health outcomes, including victimization in the past 12 months, smoking, substance use, mental health, and other sexual and reproductive health problems. And interesting, overall, what we found on that phase is that a lot of the findings that we found in the qualitative phase were echoed in this quantitative phase. So, for example, witnessing community violence was really prevalent in communities such as Baltimore and Johannesburg, and it wasn't so in the other communities. And the other thing that we noticed is that their perception of the physical environment also really mattered, but it mattered in different ways. So, for example, the perception of the physical environment would matter to some health outcomes and to males versus girls, but it wasn't consistent across the sites. So the way in which these factors kind of interacted with each other made a difference in terms of what we saw. So from all of that, what we concluded was really that these perceptions of both the physical and the social environment. So the other thing that came across was this, you know, in Baltimore and Johannesburg, a lot of the kids are being raised in single households, single parent households. So in Baltimore, the kids described, especially in the qualitative phase, how you know, a lot of their fathers were in jail, and they were being raised by other members in their family other than their parents. And Johannesburg, that's a city and country in South Africa that's been hit by HIV/AIDS. So a lot of the parents had died because of that. So although the circumstances differed, the fact is that these kids were, a lot of them were being raised essentially on their own or with other non-biological parents, adults. So these combination of these factors that were so similar between these two sites also then we saw had similarities with the outcomes that we saw. So in both sites, adolescents in Baltimore and Johannesburg had the highest rates of unwanted pregnancy, substance use, victimization. And so it was really kind of an eye-opening just to see how these neighborhood influences really impacted on their health outcomes.
And Casimara, this is to me an amazing study. When I first saw the top and then read pieces of it in the journal, it was really shocking, but eye opening, and in some levels surprising, and on other levels not surprising.
Mm-hmm.
To me, given the number of political and social issues that surround these issues, these places as well. But I'm going to bring my other panelists in here to get their commentary, and but not just commentary, also your commentary and questions in creating this dialogue with Dr. Mowry. And Dr. Lawrence Brown, why don't you begin?
Well, you know, the first thing is I think this is a very provocative and much needed study to understand globally how youth are thinking about their cities. But I would say that given what's going on with Boko Haram in northeast Nigeria,
mm-hmm.
I'm almost certain that the youth in that portion of Nigeria would say that it's worse there than it is in Baltimore.
They're in war.
Right, right,
right.
So we're talking about
at some point. There's some war happening here too.
Right. I'm just saying that the city selected is on the other side of Nigeria, the southeast side of Nigeria. So we have to keep in mind, you know, mm-hmm. what's going on there in Nigeria, and when we make mm-hmm. our comparisons, because there are some areas that are worse. In some areas that are better, like any nation in the world.
But when you the place, well, let me just take a step back. I mean, because mm-hmm. I mean, the Boko Haram area is a very non-urban area in northeast Nigeria, Niger, and Chad, and mm-hmm. it's very different. But mm-hmm. but that, to me, and I see what you all think, and Ronnie, I want you to come in, please, Dr. Mowry, come back as well. I mean, the idea that there are certain factors that have to be at play here.
Mm-hmm.
Why children in Johannesburg and Baltimore feel more threatened, more alone, and when the part of the study that showed the teens were given cameras to photograph, mm-hmm. that even though they photographed desolation in their communities, the teens in Baltimore saw the same pictures and rated their communities very low, as opposed to what happened in New Delhi, where they rated them very high. And so there's something at work here that I think that we need to take note of.
I just have one question. So it was Baltimore, Johannesburg, Shanghai, New Delhi. What was the last
Ibadan,
city?
Nigeria.
Mm. Ibadan, Nigeria.
Yeah.
Mm. Well, it's interesting to me because as an educator, particularly focused on black children across the world, it's interesting to me that the way that these data fell out was around some racial lines, not just poverty, because I've always argued the intersection of race and poverty is more devastating just being poor. And I think we try to tease out poverty as a driver in perception, which it is. But when you intersect that with issues of race and there's a global identity of being black in certain environments that I think impacts kids' perceptions of their reality. And I don't think they can articulate that, but I think some of that is what she's seeing in these similar ways that they conceptualize their communities. That's what I would argue.
Well, actually, we did measure stigmatization and discrimination. But the difference in Baltimore is that we had 98% of our sample African-American, right? So they were homogeneous in a way, whereas the other sites, for example, our site that we selected, the researchers in Johannesburg selected a community called Hillbro, which is a very high-dense urban area. But what's different is that they have a lot of migrants, so people that are coming from different African cities that are also living there. What we found is that adolescents in Baltimore did not feel discriminated against compared to the other sites. So it wasn't kind of the main driver in a lot of these things.
Well, I didn't say discrimination. That's not what I'm speaking to. There's a difference.
It wasn't a race issue. They really talked. It didn't come out as race because it really was through these other ways that urban poverty. So they're close about Baltimore kids.
Well, I don't think the experience of race is always, as a researcher myself in issues of around black children, I don't think that the ways in which we're conceptualizing discrimination may pick up how that is in fact impacting perception. And I don't know what your research methods were. I'm not going to dispute that on the air, but I do believe that there is a natural perception of blackness that permeates, that is just the water we swim in, that is hard to deconstruct in a racial. It may not be considered discrimination mm-hmm. or someone's out to get me, but there are ways that we conceptualize blackness and poverty that plays out in our perceptions of our reality. So that's my point. I'm not saying that in your study that you didn't account for that, but I just thought it was interesting that when you talk about that kind of intersectionality, it showed up in the results.
Right, but what I want to say is that race and poverty are kind of these huge constructs, right?
Mm-hmm.
But they have to
Absolutely.
Operate in a certain way.
Exactly.
So how they operate, though, and what we found, is it operates in these different ways, such as a lot of these kids in Baltimore are feeling, they basically felt unloved in the qualitative findings.
Felt a what?
Unloved.
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 So they talked about, there's a quote that I have right now, that one kid in a photo voice, he was a photo voice participant, said, in order to have a healthy community, you have to have neighbors who are willing to do something about it. And he took this picture of all this trash that was thrown out right by the apartment. So it plays out in different ways in terms of their perception. So if they're growing up in an area where all they see is trash and rats and vacant buildings, which was very prevalent in the first phase, That says something to them, that goes into their skin, so to speak, and say, well, what's going on here?
I think we're having two different conversations, and it's okay, as I get where you're going, but I'm a, yeah.
Well, I mean, let me try to pull, I mean, I don't think they're actually that far apart. Let me try to pull back together. Let me go to Lawrence first and come right back to Dr. Mari.
Yeah, I mean, I do find it interesting that Johannesburg and Baltimore had the worst outcomes. Because you're talking about two societies where apartheid
exactly.
was practiced and enacted in law. Garrett Power from University of Maryland wrote a paper called Apartheid Baltimore Style, the residential segregation ordinances of 1910 through 1913.
Yeah.
There was a lawyer from South Africa who wrote in the Baltimore Sun in 1995 an article called Housing Segregation Apartheid in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
So we're talking about two societies that practice, you know, stringent forms of white supremacist racism.
Thank you. That's my
point. So even when we're measuring social capital, when we're measuring violence witness, we're witnessing the residue and the long-lasting implications of apartheid that the other cities, incidentally enough, don't have, although Ibadan would have had colonization from the British in Nigeria, right, which is different.
So
thank you, said it well.
I don't dispute you at all, but I'm just saying that part of the kids' perceptions, though, how they come across is what we're measuring.
Exactly.
So we wanted to hear more from the voices of them. What do they see? And that's how it's being played out. I'm not saying that it's not because of these, you know, large urbanization and race. Yes, they all are these larger factors. But what we wanted to see is, and hasn't been measured, is, well, how do the youth perceive this then? How does it play out? And that's what this study is about.
And I think that, and that what hit me as I read this study, and I was thinking also as I was reading the study, Dr. Murray and Drs. Brown and Ellis here in the studio, that as I read it, I thought about what you came up with and how you came up with these with these findings. And I also then began to think about the political and social implications of that of the findings, mm-hmm. and how they actually do feed on one another, mm-hmm. and give a different angle to the depth this report came up with. And I think that you know, that when you have, and that might tell us what we need to do to begin to think about how you address this, A, because of poverty, mm-hmm. and the health outcomes that come out of this because of poverty, and B, mm-hmm. Politically how you think about these things, about how you address them given the societies like South Africa and the United States, which were built on racism that kept that layered this deep racism on top of poverty.
Poverty, yes.
That also has to go to how people perceive themselves.
Exactly.
And the perceptions people have of themselves.
Exactly. That's my point, that you can't alienate perception from these broader issues that plague you almost like the water you swim in. Mm-hmm. And it shapes the way young people see their lives, even if they're not able to articulate it in certain kinds of ways. It's just kind of like, well, it's just dirty in my neighborhood. So the question I would ask them is, what about that? What about that reflects how you see you? So there's a
exactly what, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, like
that's
how does
they feel unloved? They don't feel cared for. Mm.
And as a black woman in academia, I don't feel love either. So I understand the not feeling love. You know, so there's a whole world that perpetuates that beyond just your family and familiar environments. There's a society that gives messages that then exacerbates when you have these issues of single parent homes, et cetera, that really leaves you unloved.
I have to jump, we have to take a very quick break here. We're going to come right back and go to the phones as well, 410-319-8888, and talk about, I think this is to me, a very groundbreaking report, mm-hmm. on a number,
mm-hmm.
of levels.
It is.
And we're lucky to have Kristen Murray with us. We'll be right back with Dr. Kristen Murray, Dr. Lawrence Brown, and Dr. Ronnie Ellington. Stay with us.
Jews are so cruel. One day you're so happy now. The next day you in tears. So you take it where you find it. Or leave it like it is.
Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner here on WEAA 80.9 FM, your source for cool jazz. And when we went to break, we heard the great Bobby Bland singing That's the Way My Love Is, who was born this day in 1930. And we just came back from break hearing Elmore James, another great blues man born on this day in 1918. And That It Hurts Me Too was we heard by that. And so in some ways,
The blues.
It's the blues. It says a lot about the report, I think. And it does. I mean, because I think they're connected. I can write a song to this. And Dr. Kristen Murray, who wrote this report, is with us. She's assistant professor in the Department of Population, Family, and Reproductive Health at the Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health, the Center for Adolescent and Global Health. Dr. Ronnie Ellington, associate professor of mathematics education at Morgan State University. Dr. Lawrence Brown, assistant professor of public health at the School of Community Health and Public Policy here at Morgan State University, and tweets at Be More Doc. And we had a caller call in saying, she left a message, didn't want to get on the air, but she left this message. She said, driving through the city of Baltimore, people there are great people. The environment doesn't define who they are. But her observation is that every time she drives through the city, she doesn't see any trash cans. Maybe there's a reason the trash is out there. The city should provide trash cans. She doesn't want to get on air saying that. But in some ways, in a larger sense, I mean, there are ways to look at this both in terms of how you address the health outcomes in communities, because one of the things this report also showed and talked about was how the adverse health conditions, physical and mental health conditions that young people face in these communities affect their health as adults.
Absolutely.
They're precursors to what happens. And we can see that in this community in Baltimore, in spades, you know, that it's that deep. And so, you know, when you read a report like this, I think there are all kinds of implications. The question is where this report takes us and what we think the response to a report like this should be. I mean, it really – the headline in the paper jumped out to me, but it jumped out even more as I went through the report. So what does it say about what this says about what we should be discussing and thinking about as a result of this report? Let me start with the author report and then go back to our panelists in the studio. Dr. Murray?
I mean, I think that the kids that we interviewed were saying a lot of what they would like to happen. So it's like if we could listen more to their concerns and really get their voices heard, I think that makes a huge difference. So, for example, the girls were saying, you know, one of the biggest concerns that they had, and this was across sites, but in Baltimore and Johannesburg, sexual and reproductive health problems were very prevalent. I mean, girls were constantly talking about baby mamas and unwanted pregnancy as being, you know, a very big concern to them. We didn't see that in the other sites, although girls did talk about sexual and reproductive health problems in India and Shanghai in particular. They were discussed in terms of gynecological, so more biologically based, whereas in Baltimore and Johannesburg was these sexual risk behaviors that they were really discussing about. And a lot of that was because, well, first of all, they talked about these lack of recreational activities for them. And so they didn't really feel that there was a safe space or a safe place for them to go to. Safety was a huge concern even for girls within their own homes. In Johannesburg, a girl talked about hearing shots even in her, you know, apartment building. And we frequently heard that in Baltimore. And so it's like we almost have to really, you know, they're eager to have something in place for them that's safe. And I think that would really, really help. And I think helping them, you know, get positive adults in the community, because they were really I asked one girl, I was interviewing her, and I said, well, is there anyone that you can turn to? And she said, no, I don't trust any adults in my life. And I feel like if I have to do anything, I have to do it on my own. So, you know, training people really to kind of reach out to these young people, I think would be really hugely important. And, you know, we've had subsequent discussions with some of the adolescents we interviewed, and they even said that there's, you know, places that they used to have that are being shut down now. And so they're like, where else do we go? And so I think those are some of the issues that they're yearning for.
And I think, you know, in public health, we understand that health in large part is attributed to social determinants of health. And so social determinants of health, one of the biggest factors of social determinants are policies. And so when I hear things like trash cans not being in certain neighborhoods, I think about city policies and how Baltimore City serves some neighborhoods like the Inner Harbor, Fells Point, Canton, better than it serves Upton, Greenmount East, and Druid Heights. I think about when I hear the locations, people, the young girls saying that they don't have a place to go. I think about the recreation centers being closed by our city, yet detention centers being open to pick kids up after the curfew. And so it's these policies that I think the youth are picking up on in many ways. They may not be articulating it, as you said earlier, you know, in a direct way. But, you know, when you hear youth in Johannesburg talking about the issues there, violence in the home, I wonder to what degree the housing segregation there play a role in terms of who had opportunity and who does not. So these social determinants and race-based policies that determine outcomes based on housing, transportation, city services, all these policies play a role, and I think the youth are definitely picking up on it.
Definitely.
And I think to me, Ronnie, in the 5 or 6 minutes we have left here in this segment, and we're going to come back to this, but I really wanted to get this out on the air today for people to kind of hear it. Mm-hmm. This to me, as I read this, there's two levels of response. One is the immediate about the kind of policies that you were talking about, Lawrence Brown, that have to be put into place that address this in communities we can control, like our own, mm-hmm. And what you can do from rec centers to health centers to the kinds of schools and all the other things that we have going here. The stopping the mass incarceration of black men mm-hmm. would be another aspect of this.
Unloved, right.
That resonated with me, and mm-hmm. I'm going to tell you why.
And the unloved part. And the second part is to me that in this is that there is a larger question that America is now wrestling with once again, since the tragedy of Trayvon Martin and ever since, and all the other episodes that have caused explosions around America of both conscience and movements, mm-hmm. To deal with the unspoken racism of this country that is deep.
Is deep.
That is reflected in this report, too, though it's not the purpose of the report, but it's reflected right. deeply in this report. So both things, to me, right. sprung out of this report for me right. as things we have to tackle on both the community level, mm-hmm. but also in a kind of a macro societal level of kind of raising consciousness and changing our perception so we can change even more.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. I don't know if I can even say all that's coming to me in my mind, because I'm an African-American female who understands what these sisters are saying, particularly the women. She talked about health issues. Let me just talk a little bit about the love and the sexual deviance, and I don't trust people.
Go ahead.
When you intersect race, poverty, particularly gender, in a society that doesn't value you. Now, you can talk about your mama and your daddy, but there is a embedded devaluing of black life, of females, and this whole I want to be loved actually permeates the need to connect sexually with people. So you got mm-hmm. these young girls who don't feel loved, and I think they said that and they directed it to their parents, but I can argue that there's a broader society's lack of love that is demonstrating itself in their realities. So you have these sisters particularly who want love, and then they go out and do certain behaviors. They have nothing to do. They don't feel loved, so they engage in certain behaviors to fill that gap. But yet they don't trust anybody, so then there's that piece that's put in the mix. To me, it's the experience of even black older women like that I talk to who have the same exact experience of not feeling the love in the society for who they are and what they bring. So then their environments reflect that lack of love, and then it's a spiral effect. That's why I keep saying you cannot separate the perceptions from the racial element. You cannot, because even those of us who make it out of poverty, the experience still remain. They remain. So how do you explain that? I've talked to sisters. I do some work with black women in my company, and they say the exact same thing. And these are women who have degrees, PhDs, the whole nine yards. They're still unpartnered. They still feel they don't have anything to do but work themselves like a workhorse to be valued. So this experience is, to me, speaking to things that's beyond just, my mama not there, or I'm a single mother. It's a societal valuing of a certain type of life. And that's what I got when I read it. I was like, it was just so shocking to me. It hit me to my core, mm-hmm. even though I'm not considered in poverty. But the experiences are very similar. So that's what I took away from that. So these sisters, these younger sisters, maybe couldn't articulate it in the best frameworks, if you will, about what was happening. But that experience drives you to sexual deviance. When you feel unloved and unvalued holistically, all you have to work with is your physicality. Mm-hmm. to get that. So there's a whole lot happening here. So I just want to acknowledge the researchers for the work they did. This was just magnificent work, just from a research standpoint.
I think
it was
so too.
Awesome.
I mean, I think that the research that Dr. Christomari did
it was
on this was incredibly deep and important. I think it should lend ourselves to the two discussions we've been having today around this report, which I'd like to come back to in the coming weeks, because your eloquent statement just now,
I'm still trying to get the love.
Ronnie Ellington, and I think that what Lawrence Brown was describing and what Dr. Myers reported, I think that the question now is how you take a report like this, popularize it in public conversation to say we need immediate change in places like Baltimore and we long-term change in societies like America to make this report not happen in the next 50 years or 100 years, whatever that number might be.
Can I make
a quick note about
poverty? It's not just poverty. It's income and wealth inequality.
Oh, yeah.
You know, the Absolutely. Larger the gap between the haves and the haves not, the more the anxiety in the society.
This is, first of all, I wanted to thank Dr. Christomari for taking time to be with us today and for the report that you produced. You see what you set off, Dr. Mari.
I love it.
Thanks for doing that.
This is what we needed.
Yes.
So, and I would like to create a larger, I mean, I would like to explore with Dr. Mari and with the two of you the possibility sometime in the next month or so to maybe have a public panel built around this report, bringing all these elements into it to talk about what this means for society. I think people and students at here and UMBC and other places need to understand this and wrestle with it to see what these mean. This is a very important report, which is why I jumped out immediately and said, please get Dr. Mari on the program and let's have this discussion. So, Dr. Mari, thank you so much for taking the time today.
It's my absolute pleasure, and I just feel so privileged to be able to talk and have this conversation. So thank you so much.
Thank you. And this is a shortened conversation because we have to cover what happened to Mr. Sterling in federal court yesterday in our next segment. And I want to thank Dr. Ronnie Ellington, assistant professor of mathematics at Morgan State, and Dr. Lawrence Brown, associate professor.
It don't matter.
They mean to demote you. And soon to be associate professor, Dr. Lawrence Brown, public health, for joining us here in studio.
Thank you.
Good to have you both here.
Absolutely.
All three of you. Thank you so much. And folks, please write to me here at steinershow@gmail.com. Let me know what you thought of this discussion. We want to continue this. I think this is a really important report and really hones in on two very important areas, both in terms of policy and in terms of where our society is. And I want you to join us with those ideas. We're going to go out with this. Okay, we're going out with That Superstition by Stevie Wonder.
Writing's on the wall.
Number one on this day, 1973. We'll be right back with Marcy Wheeler as we look at what happened with Jeffrey Sterling, the black CIA officer who was convicted on all 9 counts, and why it happened. Was it justified or not? What does it say? Stay with us. We'll be right back. Baby.